Call to order this hearing of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee. Would ask members of the public to please take your seats. Again, with approval of the no minutes this time, we will begin with authors who are in the room. Otherwise, we will revert to the schedule that's there, that's printed for you. In general, bills of members of the committee will be heard last. Members who are not members of the committee will be heard first. And we're going to begin with Senator Higgins, Senate File 2555. And if this bill is acted favorably on, it will be referred to the Finance Committee. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, it's 2585, I believe.
I'm sorry, yes. It's correct as it's printed, 2585.
Okay, good.
Senator Higgins.
And Madam Chair, the piece of this bill that brings it to state and local government operations and oversight is Section 7, which talks about a collaborative that is actually existing in the Department of Transportation. The bill is about the disadvantaged business enterprise programs that are run through the Department of Transportation. These are women and minority-owned businesses, and they contract for work through MnDOT. The collaborative is actually an existing group, so we're not establishing it technically in this bill. It's been actually working for about 18 months. And it has participants that represent stakeholder groups, including disadvantaged business enterprises, workforce developers and training programs, unions, general contractors and subcontractors, MnDOT, including their civil rights and contract business areas, employment business advocates, Federal Highway Administration, and non-union workforce representatives and contractors. Excuse me. The group is currently staffed by the Department of Transportation, and in our bill we continue that management. We also advocate for a greater organizational structure for the collaborative, and the group plans to address this structural issue in upcoming meetings. My original bill set forth principles for the Department of Transportation's DBE program, and based on the feedback from MnDOT as well as the stakeholders within the collaborative, they wanted me to empower their group to address the principles and then return back to the legislature next year. I've worked closely with Senate Counsel for the Transportation Department, and Mr. Bonner has been very helpful as well trying to put this all together, and I'll stand for questions.
I'll ask for comments from members, but I would draw your attention, Senator Higgins, to page 5, line 523. You asked for the collaborative to report its findings and legislative recommendations to the chairs. You asked for that. Two things I would suggest. One, legislative recommendations, including draft legislation, because we like to get language, not just principles. Mm-hmm. And then I think January 3rd is way too short a timeline, because people, a lot of people are gone in the middle of December, and to ask for a report that quickly after the first of the year, when people may be coming back from vacations, particularly January, New Year's, that to recommend that you change that to February 1st.
We can do that. Madam Chair, I think both of those are very good additions to the bill.
Senator Betzel, would you make that motion to amend in those two ways?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone, any question from members about those two changes on page 5? Any questions from members about the issues that are inside the jurisdiction of this committee? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in favor or in opposition, once again, to the issues that are within the jurisdiction of this committee?
Should we vote on my amendment?
No.
Okay.
We have the Betzel Amendment in front of us. We're just trying to move so fast here. We have the Betzel Amendment in front of us. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Betzel moves that Senate file 2585 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you all very much. As members, now that we have more members here, can see that we have a very long agenda. We don't know if we're going to just move right along or whether we're going to get bogged down at any given time. As the day progresses, if members would like half an hour break to get something to eat, let me know and we can recess for a half an hour if you think that's necessary. Be happy to accommodate you as we go through. I know that Senator Sharon cannot be with us today, and I think someone else was presenting her bill for her. Senator Erickson Robes, is she present? Okay, then we will go to the next member who's present, Senate File 2741, Senator Murphy. Senator Murphy, welcome to the committee. The jurisdictional issues of your bill that are before us have to do with three sections. Let me find it here. And I'm going to ask Mr. Bodern to identify those sections so that where they are in the bill, and they do have to deal with the request for fairly broad exemption from rulemaking, and this is not a pro forma request, so we need to have some discussion about why they need to be exempt from rulemaking. But Mr. Bodern, would you point out the pages for members so they can get there?
Madam Chair and members, the first rulemaking provision is a complete exemption from rulemaking. That's on page 6, beginning on line, on line 6.
Where is it now?
Page 6, line 6. It's the paragraph C, and that's an exemption from rulemaking for standards and a process for certifying chemical monitoring devices.
Okay, and the second one?
The second provision is found on page 14, beginning at line 4, subdivision 7. And that provides for, that's a general rulemaking provision. And then the final provision, rulemaking provision, is on page 14, line 20. That is an expedited rulemaking provision for the administration of 169A.55 subdivision 4.
So these three provisions dealing with rulemaking are different, but the most significant one, Senator Murphy, I think, is the, as I understand it, is the one on page 6 where the department is asking for the ability to adopt performance standards with regard to your bill for the certifying the ignition interlock is what it amounts to, and that to be able to adopt those standards without having any rules whatsoever, but without going through the rules thing. So maybe if you would speak to that, mm-hmm. the first one, Mr. McCormick and the commissioner, we'd be happy to receive an explanation about why you think it's a good policy not to have rules.
Madam Chairman, I'm going to let the
Commissioner and Ms. McCormick also speak on behalf of these rules, but as we know, this interlock system is a newer technology, and it's changing all the time. And everybody knows that. I mean, if you buy a computer today, by the time you get it home, it's outdated. In this area, a lot of these devices are changing and becoming, you know, having more, they have more functions. They work faster, different technology. And as this technology emerges, we're finding we're getting a better product at a cheaper rate. I'll let Ms. McCormick and Commissioner Campion speak to the specifics on 6.6, but that's my understanding, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Murphy. Commissioner, did you want to
Madam Chair,
begin?
Thank you very much for the record. Michael Campion is my name. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. Just a comment about the overall bill and the accompanying language that deals with
Let's
the
see, excuse me. Maybe Mr. Brickwitty, could you help them clean up the confusion there? We have a lot of bills and a lot of amendments, so we want to make sure that they don't get spilled. Commissioner Campion, please continue.
Madam Chair, just a couple comments about the overall bill and the accompanying language. It's a very important public safety issue for us as a department, for the traffic safety community. I'd like to thank the Madam Chair and all the members in the Senate and the House for the last number of years for passing some tremendous traffic safety legislation. Everybody knows we've had the lowest traffic fatalities in 40 years, and it's a tribute to the legislature. I will let Ms. McCormick talk about the specifics of the bill as it pertains to rulemaking. But again, Madam Chair, we're very strong support of this bill and appreciate the author's work on this very important issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Ms. McCormick, if you'd identify yourself, please, for the committee. And the
Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick with the Department of Public Safety, the Division of Driver and Vehicle Services. And you pointed out, Madam Chair, the three areas with rulemaking, I think what we're looking at is a program that we have now been operating on, operating on a pilot basis right now, and so we have experience. The legislature is required to receive a report at the end of next year about this two-year ignition interlock program that we're currently administering. And as Senator Murphy was pointing out, one of the things that we have found out is that the technology is changing on a rapid basis. In some of the other hearings we've been having, we've been hearing about ignition interlock with camera devices. There's also talk about a system that would instead use a biometric that's under development at this time. And so our concern is that we not be able to address new technology and its use in our programs through a rulemaking process. We do understand that we do need to have a certification process and program guidelines, and those would be developed through a contractual basis with the vendors that we would be using, and so those would have to still submit to the state procurement process, and those documents would be available and be made public, and so they would be able to be scrutinized, and they will have to follow state procurement processes. And so we believed that that would be the proper place to be able to do it and to be able to address a new technology as it would come along. And as
Ms.
you
McCormick,
know,
one of the concerns that I had was the way in which the information was going to be made available to the public, some sort of notice to the public, the language here did not address that. But since, as you just mentioned, there is going to be a public process. It's just not going to be done through rulemaking, or you're proposing not to do it through rulemaking, but through the procurement process. So any member of the public, any attorney, will be able to have access to your standards and procedures. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct.
So that deals with page 6.
Correct.
The next one was on page 14 and is slightly different with regard to the program guidelines there. At least the language is different. What are you proposing with regard to sub 7?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the rulemaking that would occur in this particular case would mean that we would be allowed to be able to try to use an exempt process to be able to make changes that we may currently have in our rules that would need to be amended in order to be able to accomplish what we are setting out to do in our standards and guidelines. Certainly, the department would be able to present a good cause argument as part of that if we found it necessary, if the committee would want us to have that requirement. I think the department would be willing to certainly use the good cause part of the exempt rule process so that we would be able to publicly explain why we were making those changes and be able to accomplish it in a more expedient process.
And the request that paragraph B not apply, what does that refer to for the members' benefit?
That does refer to the good cause exemption.
So that's what they are proposing here. And then the section 16 with regard to general rulemaking, if you just explain that.
And Madam Chair, that comes, that also has to do with the fact that this particular statute talks about rehabilitation requirements and reinstatement requirements in the section of the bill 169A.55. And so what we're talking about there is that we would like to, if we needed to make changes to the reinstatement requirements or rehabilitation requirements that the department has, and those rules are found under Chapter 7503.1700, that certainly at that point what we're hoping to do is to make those as well as quickly as possible, and certainly there again, I believe that we would be able to provide a good cause agree or argument as to why we needed those rules. As you know, the Office of Traffic Safety had an 18-month program of committee meetings with all the stakeholders that work on DWI-related issues. And these recommendations that are in here are a product of that 18-month study. So we do believe that we have gotten feedback from those people that work on these issues on a daily basis. But certainly we would be able to make a good cause argument if that would be necessary.
Okay, we've heard the explanation of the reasons for the request and wanting to point it out because it is fairly unusual, the request that DPS is making here, and I want to make sure that members are aware of that. Are there questions for Senator Murphy or the Commissioner or Ms. McCormick with regard to their request? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak in opposition to those three sections of the bill? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 2741, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. Senator Murphy?
Madam Chair, there is someone here to testify against the bill, the overall flavor of the bill, or at least one small section.
We only
section.
Take testimony on in opposition on the issues over which our committee has jurisdiction. Otherwise, we would be having widespread. I mean, we'd have original hearings again. So if there's someone who wants to speak about the rulemaking, the request for exemption from the rulemaking, but not to the policy of using ignition interlocks, If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
My name is Robert Pomplin, Loss Control Services. I train a lot of the bartenders and wait staff dealing with the Rule 7515. Says you shall refuse service to people of questionable character and any IDs you find to be not satisfactory, and the rules dealing with the B card and how it affects the safety and in protecting the drivers in the state and also the people from the opportunity of the at-risk people getting access to alcohol. And I think by eliminating the B card on the back, through if it's through the rules that you choose to do this, that you eliminate the opportunity of a lot of people in society to get access to alcohol, which would put them in harm's way in violation of the conditions of their license. And I think it's something you need to look at because it may affect people and create an opportunity for death and also injury to the general public by removing that. There are a lot of good bartenders and wait staff that check the back of the licenses to see if they have the restrictions, and if they do, they limit that opportunity. And for the public safety of the state, I wish you to consider this, and I thank you for the opportunity of testifying.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Thank you very much, sir, for your testimony. We had the Senator Bickerman renews his motion that Senate file 2741, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We will go back now as people are in the room. Senator Olson. Senator Olson has two bills, Senate file 2553 and Senate file 2199. Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry. What we're doing, I didn't see Senator Kubley, Senator Olson, and he was number one, and he is now in the room. So we'll take his two bills and then your two bills in the order in which you're listed on the agenda. Senator Kubley brings a Senate file. First of all, Senate file 2594. Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Sorry for my delay. I had a bill up in judiciary. But anyway.
Everybody has a bill up in judiciary today.
Yeah,
they're in judiciary.
That's not my favorite committee, Madam Chair, but as an attorney, you may understand that.
Senator Moore, you said that.
But anyway, with me today is Glenn Hogo, who is the administrator for the Renville County Hospital, and he'd like to visit with the committee about the reason for the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Hogo, if you would explain the bill then and give us your testimony and identify yourself first.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Glenn Hogo. I'm the CEO of Renville County Hospital in Olivia. And currently, under Minnesota law, all cities and counties with a population greater than 15,000 are required to report their three highest salaries to the public. They can do this either by putting those salaries on their website for 90 days, on the tax bills that go out to all the taxpayers, or on a newsletter of general circulation to all taxpayers. There are seven cities and counties that fall in that category that have city or county-owned hospitals. And what the bill would do would be to eliminate that reporting requirement for hospitals. And the reason is that we all, with the exception, I think, of Litchfield, Meeker County, we all employ doctors. And in our case, we have eight physicians. And those are going to be the highest salaries that would be reported. That kind of ends up being a problem for us because we are in a competitive business. We have to pay a market salary, and we have to be high enough to be able to hire physicians, and we have to be low enough so that our bottom line survives. We've got to be in the right place. We're in a competitive business. We don't use any property tax money. We're not on the property tax rolls. We have a separate board. We have a separate payroll from the county. And I think it actually circumvents the intent of the law, was that if somebody had a problem with their tax bill and was upset, they could look on that website or on that tax bill or on that newsletter and find out what the three highest salaries were in the courthouse or in City Hall, not what was happening in the hospital with salaried doctors. In our county, and I think our county and Litchfield were the only ones that published it. I think some of them don't deal with it at all. But our county published the, because I wouldn't give them those salaries, they published the three highest courthouse salaries and then put a note in there to call Glenn Haugo at my phone number if I wanted to know what the, because it didn't include the hospital.
Mr. Haugo, I think you make a very good point that, okay. that the tax dollars are not supporting the members of the employees of the hospital, and what people are concerned about is those highest paid positions where their tax dollars are going. And so you're just clarifying that with this added sentence in the law. Are there questions for Mr. Haugo or Senator Kubley? Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to speak in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Carlson moves that Senate File 2594 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Mr. Haugo.
Madam Chair, do you know where it will go from here? Or
to the floor.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Kubley, then you have Senate File 2641.
I do.
Coyotes.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 2641 deals with allowing local units of government. You know, the original bill simply dealt with county boards. I have several county boards every year that ask for the ability to pay hunters to remove coyotes from certain areas of the county. This bill has the support of the Minnesota Farm Bureau, the Minnesota Farmers Union, the Minnesota Cattlemen's Association, and also the Minnesota Association of Townships. The townships did ask if they could be added to the bill in the last committee, Madam Chair. I think it's an indication of the growing nature of this problem. With me today is Mr. Padula, who farms and raises sheep north of Montevideo, and he'd like to tell the committee about some of the problems he's encountered with this species.
Mr. Padula, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bob Padula. I'm a sheep producer who lives about 12 miles northwest of Montevideo, Minnesota. I've been a sheep producer since 1972. It started off as a 4-H project that kind of went overboard. I moved to my current location in 1997 and started erecting fences and putting up things to raise sheep in my new farm. As I started doing that, I've been diligent about the fact that we do have predation in sheep and have gone to extraordinary measures to fence my perimeter with high tensile electric fencing to protect my flock, as well as putting barbed wire on the bottom to prevent the digging and things underneath it. Immediately after I went in there, I had my sheep enclosed in a small enclosure with this 7-wire fence, and experienced depredation where the coyotes actually snuck underneath the gate that I have to walk in or drive my tractor in. This was 150 feet from my house. I had a small child at the time. I was greatly concerned for that and have been working diligently to correct some of the problems with coyotes. Now to the problem that I have is I have to go to the expense now of having to double fence, where I have to have electric netting, portable electric netting, inside my current pastures, and I still have the problems with the depredation occurring. Sometimes the coyotes will still sneak in and sneak out in some of the areas where, you know, they can get in. And I never even find the animals that are lost. They just simply take the animals and leave. Other times what happens is that when they can't get in, they continually harass my livestock from the outside to the point where in the evenings now, sometimes those sheep will run around and they'll get entangled into the portable netting fence inside there, become tangled, and strangulate themselves. So I still suffer depredation losses even if the coyotes don't kill them. I know there's plenty of people who are looking at this opportunity and thing and saying that bounties do not work. Bounties do, in fact, work. They offer short-term temporary relief for me to help stop the problem. A coyote that is not there cannot breed, cannot harass my sheep. It will take time for more coyotes to come into the place. The issue I see on this is not the fact that whether bounties work. It also looks at the fact that we have bounties on other animals. There is not a problem in my community with kids on bicycles with hose and pocket gopher traps terrorizing my community. They have a bounty on pocket gophers. We don't have a problem with kids from South Dakota bringing pocket gopher feet over to Madison to collect the bounty. So the argument that bounties are fraught with fraudulent activities is just not true. And so I speak in favor of this as an opportunity to provide local government the ability to go through and help some of the taxpayers with the problem that we're having. I don't see as where a state-mandated bounty system is going to be effective. I see that as being something that the state and the Department of Natural Resources would not be very effective. If my local county wanted to spend $2,000 in five other counties, that's $10,000. I'd have hundreds of people out there going after coyotes. To have the state do that, it would cost the taxpayers of Minnesota a substantial amount of money. They'd have one person who works 9 to 5 Monday through Friday. And I still suffer the losses. So I speak in favor of this bill.
Is there further discussion on Senate File 2641, the first engrossment? Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I assume this came from the Environment Committee.
Senator Kubley.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
So our concern here is just whether we think the county or the town board should offer the bounty. They've already approved the policy.
Correct. Yeah. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Kubley, I realize that this population of coyotes is growing dramatically. I mean, they can have a lot of young ones every year, and they seem to have very few natural predators. And so we have seen in my area, which is, a South Metro area, we have seen a huge increase in them. And not only are they going after some of the livestock, but they certainly are taking a toll on wildlife like pheasants. And since this is permissive and no county or township has to do it, I think that I certainly don't have any problem with it. It would have to be a pretty serious problem in an area before the town board or the county decided to take action because, they'd have to put the bounty forward. So I think it would be fine.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, I guess, to me, I think just the fact that all of these groups are now supporting it is an indication of the increase in the numbers out there. I think, like Mr. Padula, the sheep farmers along the Minnesota River are the most vocal in their opposition to the increasing number of coyotes out there. It does seem to me that while I had one conservation officer that works for the DNR tell me that he did not believe that the wildlife within the coyotes' range could support the population in the River Valley. So to me, that's another indication that the numbers have gotten out of proportion. It just seems to me that like Mr. Petula indicates, it's a temporary fix, but it takes coyotes a while to move back into an area. So if you had a bounty on for even a couple of weeks out of a year, it would seem to me if they restricted the hunt that they would pay you a bounty in to a couple of townships that are having a serious problem, it would be beneficial to the producers that live in that area.
Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to speak in opposition to Senate File 2641, the first engrossment? Seeing none, Senator Lori moves that Senate File 2641 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Kubley.
Thank
Senator
you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Olson. Mm-hmm. Senator Olson also brings us two bills. The first is Senate File 2953. Welcome to the committee, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 2953 is a fairly simple bill. It does prohibit city council members from also being full-time employees in the city, which they are now a part of the governing body. It may come as a surprise that that is not already in current law. That particular provision is already in statute for school districts and for counties, but it is not for cities. And Section 1 of the bill applies to charter cities. Section 2 applies to statutory cities. It came on my radar because one of the 20 cities that I represent in Western Hennepin County happened to have some experience with this when a supervisor of public works ran for city council and was elected. And checking with the Attorney General's office, they found that it wasn't illegal. But that term is finishing, I think, this year. The city manager, just as to what the complication can be, city manager said to me, it is a little difficult. Am I his boss or is he my boss? So with me today is the mayor of Mound. If there are any questions that you might have as to why this may not be a good idea to encourage in other cases, and perhaps we should make our statutes consistent. Be happy to respond to any questions.
Mr. Mayor, if you'd like to make comments, that'd be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Mark Hannes. I am the mayor of the city of Mound.
Mayor Hannes.
I could present, I could stand for questions. Just to add a bit to what was said, again, we have an issue here with separation of interests, and we've got a public interest, we've got employment issues, and we have personal issues, and there are sometimes very gray lines between them, and that has become an issue in some occasions. We find the situation where this individual has to step down many, many times to avoid a conflict of interest. That's when he agrees that there's a conflict of interest. And that leaves us with a council of four. And there are cases where we have to vote, and it requires four votes in the affirmative to pass something. So that leaves us with a very difficult situation to deal with. Another issue is that in a statutory type B city such as we are, mayors and city council members are not allowed to deal directly with employees or deal with city operations. That requires the city manager, and we have to pass through the city manager to do that. In this situation, it's very confused because this individual does that on a daily basis as part of his job, yet as part of his other job, he's not allowed to do so by statute. So it raises some serious questions. There's been a lot of public outcry as well, a lot of confusion as to how this can even be occurring. They don't understand how it can actually even happen.
Senator Olson, are you aware of any other city where this phenomenon has occurred? And are you, I know you're, or I think what you're saying with the effective date is that it does not affect the individual in the city of Mound with regard to either the employment or the term of his office.
Madam Chair, I've been aware of I think an instance where somebody was elected but then left the employment. resigned and did not continue. But Gary Carlson is here for the League of Minnesota Cities. I have worked with them on it. While they don't take a position, I'm sure that if you had some questions of them, they would
right,
be
we'll
happy to respond.
Right, we'll ask Mr. Carlson. We don't, I mean, this is prospective, and we want to make sure that it doesn't upset the apple cart in any other in any other municipality. Mr. Carlson, if you would identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I've worked with Senator Olson on this bill. We have no official position, so I'd say we are neutral on the bill. We do appreciate that it has the prospective effective date. I think that will take into account anybody that currently would be in a situation that would create a conflict between their city council position and a city position.
So no one who is currently a city employee and a mayor or a city council member will be affected by this legislation?
Madam Chair, members, as I read the effective dates on both sections, I believe that is true, and that is what Senator Olson indicated to me was her intent. The one issue I did indicate to Senator Olson, and I don't believe this proposal has any effect on this, but we do have standard plan cities where the city clerk is an elected city council member by definition. And as we read the bill, we don't believe that it would create a problem for those elected city clerks. And Senator Olson indicated to me that was not her intent either. So I just wanted to go on the record to say that we don't believe that this does affect that. And as the bill is drafted, we're neutral.
Okay. Questions for Senator Olson or Senator Sieben?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, have you thought about, and I don't know of any instances where this is the case, but it seems like it's a little bit different if someone is a fireman or a police officer and they also want to serve on the city council?
Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, this I do not believe would affect volunteer firefighters or somebody that was employed by an organization that wasn't directly the city in which they were a part of. Interestingly enough, in the same city, a lieutenant in the police department did run for mayor this last time. Was not elected, but that would have really made a tough situation. A full-time employee, I don't care whether they're a police in the police department or in another role, there's going to be conflict and difficulty, and I don't think it's something that should be encouraged.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, I do need to state for the record that there are other cities that are facing this cloquet in my jurisdiction. Does have a sitting city council member that I believe is either a police officer or a firefighter, I'm trying to remember which, and serves in both roles as a not a volunteer but a hired position. And I've heard from both sides very clearly on this issue. I mean, the people of Cloquet understood pretty clearly that they were electing a person that was employed by the city. And the city, on the other hand, has been placed in some difficult situations with votes. And this the issue of are you my boss or my employee is a very real issue. But I think that came out pretty clearly in the elections up in Cloquet. And so it does, there are other cities, and it's a pretty tough issue.
Senator Lori, I think that, you know, one of the things is consistency, however, across local governments. We don't permit county employees to be county commissioners. We do not permit school district employees to be school board members of the district in which they reside. Now, my own school district, a school board member, long-term school board member, in the Robbinsdale School District was a City of Minneapolis school teacher, and that's just, and that was not a violation of anything, and she never had to recuse herself because she was not an employee of the district, even though if she had tried to be a school board member in Minneapolis, she would not have been she would not, and lived in Minneapolis, she wouldn't have been able to do that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Do we have any state employees who are legislators?
I don't believe so.
Well, Madam Chair, what's a state employee? I am an adjunct faculty at Metro State. Is that a state employee?
Madam Chair?
She's not full-time.
Is it full-time?
I don't recuse myself on any votes on higher education.
Madam Senator Stephen points out that you're not a full-time permanent employee of anything other than the Senate. And actually, you're not even a member. You're not an employee of the Senate in that regard. I don't know
I'm just wondering how far this goes. I can see, Madam Chair, in a small city where, you know, the city council is dealing with a lot of issues. I mean, we are a big state. A lot of people, we deal with a lot of different issues. But I'm just wondering about this, how far this conflict goes.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, as an adjunct faculty member, are you a full-time employee and that this only affects full-time permanent employees?
Senator Carlson?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, it's real clear to me that if you were a council member that you would be prohibited from becoming an employee. But how about if you're an employee and you want to run for office? Do you see that an employee could run for office while they're an employee and then resign or agree to resign if they were elected?
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, that is the circumstance that is an illustration here. If this law would pass, it wouldn't prohibit them from running. It would prohibit them from serving unless they left the employment of the city.
Any further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in opposition to Senate File 2953? Seeing none, Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 2953 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Olson. Now we have Senate File 2199 related to the size of the legislature. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You have a cohort.
Yes. I have asked Senator Roebling to join me because she had also authored a bill a little bit different than mine and decided not to pursue it and join me on my bill that was introduced some time ago, as have a couple of DFL colleagues, Senator Clark and Senator Wieger, and I think there's some others that are considering even adding to that fifth spot on it. Senate File 2199 does reduce the size of the state legislature. And I'd like to just address three questions about it. Why this plan, why now, and why is it workable? This plan will reduce the Senate size to 56 members and the House to 112. In other words, it will reduce by 11 the Senate and by 22 the House. And the other provision that is added to the current law is that a Senate district may not be divided in the formation of a congressional district. So if a little math test here, one of the reasons that I chose that number was that it is divisible by either 8 or 7. 8 times 7 is 56. So if we now have 8 congressional districts, we may, hopefully not, but we may be reduced to 7. But that second provision would work in either situation. The other reason is that sometimes the proposals that have come in, I think, have been a little more radical or drastic, and I think that this is more modest and reasonable, and it's not intended to be a kind of slash-and-burn approach to reducing the legislature. We do have now the largest Senate for our population in the country. We're the fifth largest legislature overall, while we're 21st in terms of population. And so I think that this plan is worthy of consideration and action. Why now? Well, why now we are faced with going into redistricting. That is a good time to do that. It is less confusing when I do mention to people just in passing that talking about having the Senate district boundaries align with congressional districts, they said yes. It eliminates a lot of confusion for people, and I think they're looking for that. Why now too is that we're often thought of as protecting our self-interest more than the interest of the broader public in some issues like this. And this is a time when, you know, there are people that have announced their retirements, and I don't think we've probably seen the end of that for this year. Others are predicting that, and I think by 2012 there will be more that will be choosing to leave this service. I'm one of those. I have probably the earliest announcer for 2012 that I do not intend to seek that. If people are not questioning my sanity, that why I'd want to even continue for two more years, given the challenges that we face. But we'll leave that to them. So that is the other thing is that we hear it. I know we hear it fairly regularly, but with the challenges that we're facing, the public confidence is not very great in our legislators and legislature. And I see this as a move to help restore that confidence, that we can and are willing to bite the bullet as well in our efforts to reduce costs. And while this is not going to solve the whole overall budget challenges, it is certainly it's a significant bite. I think it's about $1.4 million in the Senate side alone. And if you can add to that, and that's being conservative in what we think the implications, the cost of salary and benefits and also of a legislative assistant. So there may be more things that would be spin off, probably fewer bills introduced and a few other things that might affect that. And then why is it workable? I know that there are folks, particularly in greater Minnesota, that see this as, you know, altering the geography and extending the size. That's probably the toughest one. But I think there are some countervailing forces right now that make this workable. And that is, you know, many of us are immigrants to this world of technology that we live in. But there's a lot of natives out there. And many of them are coming into the legislature in recent elections, and I think we'll be doing so even more so. Technology changes the picture in terms of how we can keep in touch and communicate with our legislators and with our constituents. And Senator Ress, you and I just came from a meeting at the Twin West Chamber that was quite unique. We had the party chairs or officials from each of the three parties, DFL, Republican, and Independence Party, there responding to questions. And on the board, they asked people to get out their cell phones and text, and they put up questions, and we had immediate feedback on proportions of people who respond to a particular question on the issues that were being addressed at that meeting. Who would have thought anything like that could happen a few years back? And I don't think we've seen the end of it yet.
I still would have been more comfortable just raising my hand.
Madam Chair, likewise, you and I are immigrants to the technology. I mean, we're using it, and I think respect and appreciate a lot of it, but that is the way it's coming. And when I think of what Senate Media has done here in terms of opening those doors of communication, and that now even our cell phone we can be looking into, and it can be videoing. That personal touch the lack of it can be overcome with the technology and the way it's going. So those are that's kind of my answers to those questions. But I want to Senator Roebling have a say in it because she's already serving in a district that is larger than what these districts would be.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. When I started to think about downsizing the government, the legislature, I realized that some districts really wouldn't change in population at all, and one of them would be mine. Especially under this plan, in fact, my district would shrink. And I currently represent over 100,000 people because of the growth in Scott County. And last time we started out at 73,000 constituents each. And under this plan, considering that we still would have 5.5 million people in the state, we would be representing about 93,200 people. And like I said, some districts are already over that size. And quite frankly, I think we're functioning pretty well. In the House, the districts would go from approximately 37,000 to 46,610. And my House member that represents Shakopee and Prior Lake currently represents 57,000 people. And he's doing quite well, too. And so I think it's very workable. And with the technology we have available today, even if you are geographically removed from somewhere, you can stay in touch. There's webcams. You could have a town hall meeting set up in a library somewhere, and you wouldn't even have to be there, and you could be communicating with the people in that room. Many of us use the internet extensively, and we send out constant communications. I now have better communications with my constituents than I've ever had. You know, sending out weekly updates. They give me feedback all the time. The communication is instant. I'm not a tweeter yet, but I am also an immigrant to this technology. But it certainly is something that our new legislators are going to be using in many of their constituents as well. And the thing that we have to think about right now is this opportunity only comes once every 10 years to change the size of the districts, because it has to be tied in with redistricting, which is going to happen next year after the census is complete. One other thing, Wisconsin is a similar size state. In fact, they're 400,000 population bigger than us, and they have 69 fewer legislators. And I just wanted to point out that since 1960, 19 states have reduced the sizes of their legislatures, and it maybe more will do that in the future. But it's just an idea that government is downsizing right now. Businesses are downsizing. A lot of that is needed because of our current economic situation, and that's not really the only reason to do it, but it does streamline. And I think that it's time for us to look at it ourselves. And it's difficult because it affects our jobs. It's hard to have the employees deciding how many positions are going to be available in the job market, so to speak. But I think that if we're thoughtful about it, we'll realize that this is a good time to take us maybe from being the fifth largest legislature in the country to something slightly less than that. And it's not that dramatic. Mine was a little more dramatic. I had 50 senators and 100 House members when I drafted my bill. But I did like Senator Olson's idea of keeping them within congressional boundaries. I think that is very important for the understanding of voters, of who they have as their representatives. If we can contain them within boundaries, it certainly would make it easier.
Senator Olson, in the way that your bill is written, would it is it clear that this would only go into effect starting with districts that are drawn for 2012?
Madam Chair,
maybe it is, I support your bill, but I want to be sure that it wouldn't be something that we would have to do in.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that could be an appropriate amendment to it to make that effective.
Or Mr. Bodern, is that already the case with the bill, or would we need to say that?
Madam Chair, I think Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution takes care of that. The legislature only has the power to do it after the census.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Questions, comments for Senator Olson or Senator Roebling? Senator Pappas.
To clarify this, and maybe I missed this in your testimony, that the legislature does have the authority to do this. It doesn't take a constitutional amendment.
No, it does not.
Okay. Madam Chair, then just a follow-up. I guess I don't know. I guess I have a concern about representation, because I think the larger your district gets, as you're seeing with your district, the harder it is to represent everyone. And I'd be concerned about the loss of representation because I don't think our population is grown all that much, hopefully enough to keep our congressional seat. So I don't think after redistricting, our districts are going to be that much larger than they are currently, 70,000 or something for senators, if they went up to 75. But if in under this proposal, they would be more like 100,000, correct?
But in the 90,000 range.
90,000.
Senator Stephen and then Senator Perry.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I believe I'm going to support your bill too, but I was thinking more about the congressional district issue because in my Senate district, I have three congressional districts, so it certainly is a factor. But I'm not necessarily convinced that that is that confusing to my constituents because, for instance, if someone writes and says about a federal issue and I refer them to their congressperson, I just refer them to whomever their congressperson is and their two senators. So I don't know. I guess I'm not convinced that that is such a driving factor, that it's really that confusing to constituents to live in different or to have me represent three different congressional districts.
Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, you may be right, and it might not confuse some, but it might confuse others. That may not be the only reason to do that, but I think it is, you know, a congressional district delegation. It would be more understandable rather than being split several ways. You could also argue, I suppose, that you might have some greater influence on more of your representatives in Congress. I don't know if we do, if we have a little fraction of a piece of it or not. I've been in the same situation that you have. Sometimes it is hard to direct somebody there. You've got to probe down to where precisely they live and which boundary they're in to direct them. But if they're in your Senate district and you know what congressional district, it's very easy to tell them, who their congressional district is. Because I get calls like that. A lot of federal issues come to our attention, and I like to refer them to their appropriate federal Congress people and senators as well.
And I think, Madam Chair, and I think I do like having the ear, shall you say, of three different congresspeople because depending on their particular position on an issue, I can adjust to whom I speak with about a particular topic. Mm-hmm. But and my other point that I'd like you to address is I think one unintended consequence of shrinking the legislature to this size is that the districts that are going to the people that are going to lose representation or the area of the state that's going to lose representation is the area that isn't growing as much. So it's rural Minnesota, some parts of rural Minnesota. Could you respond to that?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, that is a factor that was decided by the courts years ago that said each person has to have the same one vote and the same power. And unfortunately, our population has been shifting. It's been shifting the entire time that I've been here. And it's one of the challenges we have as a legislature is to not be so parochial in looking after the interests of all of Minnesota to assure that there is some growth in opportunities for jobs, employment, and that kind of thing in our rural areas so that they don't experience that. Sitting on education committee, we certainly see that as school districts have challenges as their enrollment reduces and the schools are an important part of their community. So I have share those concerns. I don't know that that when all of it is being shrunk proportionally that is what would give any one region any more power. It shouldn't. It's that the power would reflect the shift of population, and that's where I think our policies, we still need to strive to be one Minnesota.
Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, Senators Roebling and Olson, I too have to agree with Senator Pappas. I'm concerned about just what you talked about, the shifting of power to where the greater population base is, in the perceived shift of power by the greater Minnesota outstate area. We already have that perceived battle between outstate in the metro, and I would hate to see it get any worse. My other concern here is I use the media. I'm on all the social media. It is the most impersonal way to touch a human being I have ever been accustomed to. And so my biggest concern by increasing the area, and let me preface this, I ran on reducing the size of government, and I believe that we need to do something here. But I don't want to become so impersonal that we can't touch the people in our districts. I think that would be worse if we lose that personal touch. I use social media. I use all of that, even in our business lives. But I have never forgotten when I was on the city council and for my 35 days here. It's that personal touch that you have with your constituents being there. And I'm afraid that we would get such a big area that we would lose that.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Perry, I couldn't agree with you more on the value of personal touch. But the density of the population doesn't rule out that difficulty. You know, people are, many of them are isolated even within those areas. And so you can't touch everybody's life. But this isn't going to change that need for everyone to, you know, try to make personal contact with the community events and things that they do. Yes, we can't get to everything in a dense area any more than the people in the rural area with communities there. Yes, the distance is greater. We compensate for mileage to go to in-district events to help people with that because it is important. I know, and that's the part, frankly, that's the part of the job that I enjoy the most, is keeping in touch and being at events so people feel that they can approach you and talk to you and bring up issues and let you know how they feel. Now, the shift to power wouldn't change with this. This has nothing to do with that. That happens with the population shift, and every time we redistrict and redraw the boundaries to assure that each of them are equal in size, there's a shift depending on where that population goes. And it's why our folks, I see Senator Tomasoni over here, why our folks from the range are wanting more jobs and working for that so that people can be employed and keep people there and not all have to, the good people there have to leave to someplace else, to the cities for jobs. So that's why I think we have a broader policy problem and challenge. I don't think it's necessarily has to be a power struggle, and it wouldn't be driven by the number of districts.
Anyone else? Senator Vickerman?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm also one who's going to step down. I've stepped down with the idea that somebody from my district, regardless if it's Republican or Democrat, will come and take my place. You will not win an election out where I am by some stupid computer, I can tell you that. They want to say hands on hands. They do. And as we move, come with me sometime. It takes me all day to get across my district, and I'm not up where the big districts are. But people want you to come and stop and visit. And that's why I've been successful. I don't even door knock. I haven't door knocked for 3 years. People want you to be there. And so I'm a little nervous about it. And as far as those little things, half the people I represent wouldn't even know how to run them. Don't take one thing away from us. Rural Minnesota is struggling as it is. We have good people, either party. But I'm going to go back. There's nothing like a handshake and one-on-one. I had more fun in campaigns. My wife would walk down this street side. I'd go down here. She'd be down there wondering where I was. You know where I was? I was in a Republican house having coffee. They just want you to be part of them. They don't get into that political stuff is much out where I live anyway. So just don't take it away. That's all I ask. I can't. I think the world of you too, but I just can't. I couldn't do it. I wouldn't be able to leave.
Senator Carlson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And senators, I really like the idea that you brought this up and brought the conversation to the front.
And I've been thinking about the pros and cons of this too. And in my district, and every district has a different character to it. My district, I have one of the largest school districts in the state, and so I have one large school board and two small school boards. I have only one county to deal with. And then I speak with Senator Kubley, who talks about the numbers of cities that he deals with and the numbers of school districts and the numbers of county boards, and I'm just, it's mind-boggling to me. And you know, one of the things that I've said to friends and spouse and all that, and this is a part-time job. This is amazing what we actually do. And I am concerned about perhaps maybe a spreading thinner where we don't quite have the ability to go to the things that we're invited to. But I also think that we need to look at it and that there's something that there might be something there. And you mentioned some savings before, and I'm wondering if you could kind of go through a little bit where you're seeing the savings, because I'm thinking, like, especially the House members, where they share legislative assistance, and I know that legislative assistance sometimes are really stretched also, and if we stretch them some more, do we still have to have more of them?
Senator Roebling?
We did ask Joanne Zoff from Senate Council to give us an estimate of the cost of a senator or Senate position, and so we have a handout on that you might find very interesting. So the total cost with an assistant averaged about $130,000 for each Senate position, and so that's where we came up with the $1.3 million savings in the Senate, and then it would be nearly twice that in the House. Some of them do share legislative assistance, so it would be slightly less than that, but their pay is almost the same. Their benefits are the same. So it would be very comparable for the members. We would be taking out 33 members of the legislature. So it would be several million dollars a year.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, my Senate district is entirely within Hennepin County. I represent 20 cities in Hennepin County and 8 school districts that go into other counties. Some of part of them go into other counties. So I kind of straddle a rural to a suburban area. So we are Minnesota politics and government is not that homogeneous, and it's not that it's unique, and it's never dull. We have some the ground rules of every person having one vote offers that equity to each person. How they're arranged and how the choices they've made affect how that representation lays out, regardless of what the number the size of it is. If we're concerned about just that it's more work for us, I think we have tools to use for some kinds of communication. I don't think if computers and all of these were looked at as a total replacement for it, I don't think it would work, because I think we're still human beings that like to get the hands-on, to know who it is we're talking to and who is serving us. And I hope we wouldn't lose it, and I don't think that we would. I think we have evidence. Senator Roebling, I don't think, is out of touch with her people at all. And it can be done. There's different challenges in different areas. So I think, I've tried to be reasonable. I mean, as I said, some Senator Cohen announced maybe he should bring out his. He was going to 45 and 90. I just think that's much too radical. This, I tried to be reasonable and have some rationale for proposing this, so I just urge your consideration. And hopefully further, allow it to go forward to let everybody talk about it.
Further comments from the members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in support or opposition to Senate File 2199?
I'm sure.
Senator Betzel.
I was splitting my time with the Judiciary Committee, so I missed some of the discussion here. But Senator Olson, I understand the rationale for 56, because if you have whether 7 or 8 congressional districts, the number works. But had you given any thought to, say, a 63-member Senate? Obviously, we don't know if it's going to be 7 or 8, but, I don't know the 63. I mean, if you happen to have seven congressional districts, you could fit nine Senate districts within it. Obviously, if you have eight, the numbers don't work. I'm not so wedded to the fact that trying to make them coterminous with congressional districts. My own Senate district has three congressional districts in it, and I border on a fourth one. It can be done, and I've got one of the fastest growing Senate districts with the city of Blaine, so I've got many more constituents now than I had before. So you can juggle it and make it work. If the legislature is somewhat smaller, we're going to have more constituents. Obviously, I see it more of a greater Minnesota problem because they have to go a lot more distance to capture the individual ones. But Senator Olson, had you given any thought to maybe going from 67 to 63 senators? And then
Mr. Chairman, it probably was, 8 times 8 is 64. Mm-hmm. Dropping 3 or dropping 4, it passed through my mind, but it didn't seem to me that was an effort worth pursuing. Frankly, I don't think it achieved any savings. I think there's other factors here. We are facing budget challenges, and I think we're facing confidence challenges. And people do like the idea that and believe we should be shrinking the size of our legislature. And if we do, I didn't want to be that radical or drastic because I'm not that mean-spirited. I hope you at least would view me that way. But I thought this was a rational number. It also did bring that correlation or connection to the congressional districts that is probably of greater ease for our constituents than it is for us. We know how to manage the political system and the arrangements more than others. But I hope we would feel that the whole congressional delegation is ours to appeal to, as we often do it as a group.
Is there further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 2199 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Chairs in doubt. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Opposed? The motion prevails 5-4.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Erickson Ropes, are you here on behalf of Senator Sharon? Is that correct? Yes, if you'd come forward, please. Senator Erickson Ropes brings us on behalf of Senator Sharon, Senate File 3073.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. First question I have to ask Mr. Bodern is about an A1 amendment. Looks like he's getting ready to pass that out. As he distributes the A1 amendment, I just want to introduce the bill quickly to you. This is Senator Sharon's bill requesting a report on the effectiveness of state programs serving people with disabilities. The community counts legislation will set benchmarks for our state so that we can meet our responsibilities to persons with disabilities. This bill would require an annual report to the relevant legislative committees having jurisdiction over services to people with disabilities. It would report on state policies and goals for those services and would provide data and measurements to assess the extent to which the policies and the goals are being met. The report would be made each January 15th, starting in 2012. Community counts will promote the services that maximize the use of our tax dollars and maximize the inclusion of the people with disabilities in our communities. It would promote innovative solutions that create a service system that we can sustain and that maintains the independence of people with disabilities. And with that introduction, I would like to acknowledge that we have Steve Larson with ARC Minnesota here and Tim Nelson with who lives in Hennepin County and directs services for disabilities at that level.
We're going to begin with the author's amendment. Senator Perry moves the A1 amendment. All in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Perry wins another one.
Right.
The effect of that was to change this consortium to ARC of Minnesota.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll have Tim go first.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Tim Nelson. I'm the CEO of Hammer Residences, nonprofit service provider for people with disabilities. And I'm also the president of the board of ARC of Minnesota. And ARC is a almost 60-year-old advocacy organization that supports people with disabilities and their families. The state of Minnesota has a long and stellar history of supporting people with disabilities and providing excellent services to them. And for that, we are very proud, I think, as citizens of the state. But we believe that we're at a point in our history where some of these wonderful services that we provided to people with disabilities are beginning to be eroded and chipped away at. And therefore, we're concerned that the community as a whole, all of us as citizens, need to be made aware of where our current status is of services to the people, to our citizens with disabilities. And therefore, our community accounts bill is aimed at informing the community of where we're at, our current status, and how we're progressing on the goals that we have for improving our services to people with disabilities. So we ask that the committee support community accounts legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I'm Steve Larson, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the ARC of Minnesota, and I'll keep my comments brief. There are multiple planning processes and task force that are going on for services for persons with disabilities, but we think there needs to be a comprehensive document that crosses the goals or puts together the goals and outcomes from many different departments so that when we do run into difficult times like we are during this legislative session, we can articulate very clearly what is being done with public dollars to support individuals with disabilities by achieving the outcomes and goals that have been agreed upon across the state. And so we are looking forward to volunteering our time from many different organizations to help put this report together. And Madam Chair, I just wanted to say that we have talked with the Department of Human Services, and they do have some concerns with the way this is currently written, and they're here to comment on that if you would care to hear from them.
Yes, we certainly will hear from them, and I would think that even though the report would be voluntary and the ARC of Minnesota could just refuse to do it, that is not the case with it's not discretionary for the Commissioner of Human Services and other state agencies, and so there's likely to be a fiscal impact anyway. Are there questions before we turn to them for Senator Erickson Ropes or Mr. Larson or Mr. Nelson? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Is there someone here from the department? Any department? Human Services, I imagine. And Mr. Bodern or Mr. McGowan, what is Minnesota Statute 3.195 sub 4?
Madam Chair, I'd have to look it up to give you the exact details, but this is a provision that allows a report to be filed electronically with, among other things, the Legislative Reference Library.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. We appreciate what the ARC of Minnesota is trying to do with this legislation, and we do support the role of the disability community in helping the department to focus our priorities and determine how to measure whether we're meeting those priorities and goals. However, we cannot support the legislation as it is written because we do believe that there will be a fiscal impact for us, and we also believe that the efforts of this report will compete with existing stakeholder and feedback venues that have been established.
And what are those?
We currently are working with a home and community-based services expert panel, which is helping us to do a statewide statewide look at services with persons with disabilities. It's through a federal grant. And then we also have a quality commission, which is established through legislation to help us look at quality of our programs across all of our services.
The fact that there would be a fiscal impact is not the purview of this committee, as you understand, and it would go to the Committee on Finance to determine whether it's appropriate to spend state agency dollars in pursuit of this. What we're dealing with is the policy of this report being generated. Senator Erickson Ropes, do you have any response? Is this report, does it duplicate what's going on elsewhere in terms of the efforts of the department, or how would it be an addition that is needed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Larson will respond based on his conversations.
Okay, Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair and committee members, I actually serve on both of the committees that Ms. Hamilton referred to, and I'm an enthusiastic member of those committees, and I think they're going to
achieve
some
great goals. Well, then you're a good person to talk about it.
Great goals. We just wanted to take it one level higher and combine not only the work that's going on at the Department of Human Services, but also look at, as you'll see, employment, transportation, those types of things. We feel there just needs to be a comprehensive view and outcomes across all areas for persons with disability, and we'd like to also work with the aging community on this, since this is a major challenge for us. And so I'll just give you an example. In the employment area, there are currently 20% of individuals with disabilities that are employed. We have a group that's met in December, and they set a goal that should be at 40%. But that's not anywhere in statute. It's not written down anywhere that we can refer to. Unless we have those types of goals for our use of public dollars, we don't feel that we're going to strive as quickly as we could to achieve those goals. So, as I said, I'm an enthusiastic member of actually several committees that the Department of Human Services and others have, and we just think that this would help complement those efforts and create one document that we could be referring to. And we're willing to be flexible as long as we're moving forward in this type of area.
Senator Erickson Ropes, it's extremely unusual to put a request of a private agency in the statutes, even if it's just session law, which this would be. It's not being codified. And I inquired, I think we've done it once last year. I'm trying to remember what the... Oh, yes, the City Clerk's Record Retention Task Force were requested to do to file a report with regard to the length of time records were being retained. But it's highly unusual. Why not require the department to do this itself, using the good offices of the Arc of Minnesota, rather than the nonprofit organization doing it and requiring the assistance of the state agencies?
Madam Chair, very good question, because I also asked the same question, Mr. Larson, this morning when I looked at the bill to sit in for Senator Sharon. I'm not sure what Senator Sharon would respond to that, but I did ask Mr. Larson that same question this morning, so I'd like to have him respond. And I do believe that Senator Sharon would be willing to continue to work on language on this bill if it would satisfy the committee. But Mr. Larson could respond.
Madam Chair and committee members, based on our experience over the last several years, we were trying to propose some language that would not generate a fiscal note. And knowing that if we require...
You haven't gotten there yet, I don't think.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely correct. And so we would just look for an opportunity to continue this discussion so we wouldn't generate a fiscal note, because we know if we require any report from the Department of Human Services or any other state department, that will require a fiscal note.
Discussion among the committee members, Senator Roebling and then Senator Lurie. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and our testifiers. Do we have any idea how many disadvantaged business enterprise owners we have? Is there a registry of them currently? And how many of them do work in the transportation field?
Senator Roebling, what bill are you referring to?
Oh, am I reading? I might be reading Higgins here.
I think you're back to Higgins. This is that is Senator Sharon's.
This will be a good question for Senator Higgins.
That bill is long gone, Senator Roebling. We're on Senate File 3073. Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, I've spoken with a lot of the disability community and believe, as they do, that such a report would be of great value, and they do recognize that it's going to have to be worked out with the department, and we're not going to pass anything in the Health and Human Service Budget Division that's going to create an extra cost in this environment. And I think everybody is fully aware of that, but would like to continue this discussion. And so if when the time is right, if no one else has questions, I would like to move this bill and offer my support for the continued discussion.
Is there further discussion from the members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition, other than those who have already spoken? Seeing none, on the policy, Senator Lori moves that Senate File 3073 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Madam Chair, as amended.
Was amended?
As amended, thank you. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank
you, Madam
much.
Chair and committee members.
Senator Tomasoni. Senator Tomasoni brings us Senate File 3075 regarding joint powers agreements. Senator Tomasoni.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chair and committee members.
Still morning.
Madam Chair, the bill before us, File 3075 refers to use of joint powers agreements, and we have a situation in our district, which I'll have our witness discuss here, but normally what's going on when we have consolidation of services, such as school districts consolidating, or when two units of government decide to use a joint powers agreement, somebody merges, and there's a couple of contracts that have to be dealt with, and the contracts are dealt with, and then the seniority is honored, and they decide which contract to use, and the list of the that they have as far as the workers is concerned is honored, and everybody agrees on something. In joint powers agreements, normally they share some kind of services like recreation services or use of some equipment or something like that. Well, we have a situation in our district where there's a potential for a joint powers agreement to actually intervene on what the bargaining units have agreed to. And so what we're trying to do here is just make sure that if they do make a joint powers agreement, that that the bargaining that's been in place is honored and that the seniority list is honored. So I'll turn this over to the my witness, who is the maybe the next governor's daughter. She's definitely his daughter, but I don't know if he's maybe the next governor. But anyway, Ida Rukavina.
Thanks for the introduction. I'm
assume she's not Steve
Georgie. No, she's not Steve Georgie.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Ida Rukavina. I'm a staff representative with AFSCME Council 65. In my work in northern Minnesota, I represent many small cities, and one of the cities I represent is the city of Gilbert. On the Iron Range, Gilbert and Biwabik are two small cities that are approximately 10 miles away from each other, and they've been looking at cost-saving measures, and it was first introduced as cost-saving measures to explore equipment sharing, which, you know, I think everyone thinks would make sense. As discussions progressed, which we have not been yet a part of, there was a contract that was introduced, and what it essentially said was that the Gilbert city employees would be terminated and then rehired under the city of Biwabik. The city of Gilbert employees have been represented for over 30 years with AFSCME. They obviously had an election and chose AFSCME as their bargaining, as their union to represent them. So our concern is that obviously a city would, I think, in effect, be choosing the union that the employees are going to then be a part of. What we're asking is to be part of that discussion, and, you know, we want to work with the cities on cost-saving measures, but we want to work with the cities in forming whatever joint powers agreement comes in effect to make sure that our employees' rights aren't, you know, their contracts aren't just terminated.
Are there questions for Senator Pomassoni or Ms. Riccovina? Senator Olson.
Madam Chair.
Wait till you get older. You'll understand how that happens.
There's a police department merged in my district, and, you know, I wasn't sure the process, but what is the standard process? Because you'd think that, or my first thoughts would be that it'd be more of a merger, and, you know, seniority would kind of fall into place on from both the two entities that merged together. So I am a little surprised with the process that you're explaining.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Thomason.
Senator Olson, I'll let Ms. Riccovina address this. But normally what happens is it's the larger bargaining unit is the one that takes precedence. And they do normally sit down and discuss the two contracts, and they normally do honor the seniority that is in place within the two units, so that if two units come together and they've got a 30-year employee in this unit and they got a 30-year employer in this unit, that they honor those longevity of their contracts, so that they stay basically in the same area as far as their seniority is concerned. In this particular instance, what they're trying to do is they're trying to say that the Gilbert employees are going over to Biwabik, and then they're going to start over at ground zero. So the Biwabik employees will have their seniority in place, but the Gilbert employees will lose all their seniority. And so, joint powers agreements haven't traditionally been used for that type of a movement. And so, I don't know if Ida can add to that.
Do you need further comment?
That was a pretty good description.
Okay. Is there further discussion on Senate File 3075? Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or opposition? Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I discussed this bill briefly with Senator Tomassoni and Ms. Riccovina this morning, and I haven't had a chance to come up with any better language yet. Just want to go on the record that we have some concerns with making sure that we don't create barriers or disincentives to use joint powers arrangements as an innovation tool. I will continue to work with Senator Tomassoni to try to see if we can address the concerns we have on the bill.
What are the concerns, Mr. Carlson?
That we could create a disincentive or make it impractical to use joint powers in certain situations if we have two unions that have vastly different contract arrangements. We just need to find a way to make it work better so that we don't create a disincentive on or a barrier to using joint powers arrangements for service provision.
Questions, comments? Anyone else wish to speak? Mr. Carlson? No, we generally, these bills are out there, and if lobbyists have issues with them, we expect them to contact an author prior than to just before a meeting, a hearing. It's not fair to the author to just, and I know you know that, Mr. Carlson, but I need to say it for the record.
Madam Chair, although I'll note this bill was just recently introduced. The date
true.
On the top of it was drafted 3/4/10.
Right?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Mr. Carlson.
Keith Carlson, Executive
Point
Director.
Point well taken. Thank you.
Executive Director with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Madam Chair, I share the League of Minnesota Cities concerns. We do have a number of provisions within the joint powers law that provides for the carryover of accumulated vacation and sick leave, and in some instances preservation of seniority rights. But this legislation goes far beyond that. I'll just make a general comment that counties, cities, school districts, and other local government, as well as state entities, are using joint powers agreements to do exactly what you're telling us what you want us to do, to use collaboration, to use innovation, and anything that impedes on that will frustrate what literally are hundreds of joint powers agreements that have already been implemented and are certain to be implemented in the future. So we have indicated we'll work with the author to address the specific concerns here, but are concerned about the broadness of the current language in this legislation.
Senator Roebling, and then I have a couple of comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, we heard several bills a couple of days ago about innovation commissions and boards that we are going to develop to try and look at how we can collaborate and innovate. And we do need to set up a framework for how that's done, but we don't want to set up too many roadblocks, because I think that we have to do it. We can't keep doing government the way we've always done it. I don't know that our economy will ever allow us to do that. So I am concerned, and I don't know if they can work something out, but I don't want major roadblocks in the way of collaboration and innovation, or else those commissions and boards that we're thinking of setting up, we might as well not even bother, because they will be dealing with public entities and how to merge and collaborate those organizations, those units of government, and we don't want to make it too difficult.
Senator Tomasoni, it's my sense that it would be very helpful if you could spend some time with local government folks and respond to their concerns. I understand that technically the bill has met the deadline in the House because of the committee that it was referred to. We will hear, very willing to hear your bill next week to meet the second deadline, but I don't think it's ready today, is my opinion. And so would like to lay it over, and then we'll bring it back.
So, Madam Chair, it did pass the House committee in.
It was referred to. It's in a finance committee there. So, in Representative Rukavina's division. So we don't. So we doesn't need to pass today in order to meet the deadlines in this committee. So I'm asking that we lay it over, and we'll bring it back next week, and hopefully there'll be some reconciliation with provisions and with local government concerns. And we're checking right now with the folks over there to make sure that is correct. So at the very least, we would temporarily lay the bill over until we determine that.
Unless, Madam Chair, you would like to refer it to my committee.
No.
I think we'll keep it here for the policy. But we would intend to bring it back up. But since I do want the local government folks an opportunity to work with you, and also, as Senator Betzel pointed out, it's a recent introduction. And I don't think the deadlines are jeopardized with laying it over.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, if you find out the deadlines are jeopardized after I leave,
we will notify you.
Will you send it out of here
before the committee is over today?
Okay. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
So, Senate File 3075 is laid over. Senator Dahl, are you in the room? You're next.
Madam Chair? I think we should wish Senator Dahl a happy birthday.
Senator Dahl, happy birthday. Congratulations on making another year.
Another cycle around the sun. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Senator Dahl, where's the cake?
It's down in my office.
Oh, it is? Okay, great.
You're all welcome to join. You know, cookies and cake.
Senator Dahl brings us Senate File 2908. We have before us the first engrossment of a bill that modifies a statute that was passed in the 2009 session. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a fairly simple modifications that we're doing just to
to this bill. It was in 2009, as pointed out, the legislature passed provisions to achieve a more effective and efficient human service delivery system within our state. And what we're doing with this is just to make some clarifying changes to the language, some enhancements as well, some cleanup that would allow for us a certain degree of flexibility for these service delivery authorities to be developed, and also just to be, again, a bit more effective and efficient in how we deliver these services. I did pass through the House Health, Housing and Family Security Committee without objection. We are working with one group of the AFSCME to work out some specific language, and we understand that they're, you know, willing to work on that over the interim to make sure that all of their concerns are taken care of. Other than that, it is moved through the House as well, and I can have my testifiers here point out anything, any questions you might have about it. It's basically some clarifying language. The big things I would point out is that we're going to be able to allow the authorities, the council, which has been established, to review and make recommendations on applications from a service delivery authority for waivers of statutory rule program requirements to provide a little more flexibility so that they can determine what the most cost-effective means of achieving a specified measurable goals in this human services delivery program. And then allow them also to make sure that they're looking at federal funding and conforming with any federal regulations that may be in place. So, and the steering committee should also identify and incorporate federal performance measures in its recommendations for those program areas where federal funding is contingent on meeting federal performance standards. And if we find that there are some counties that aren't meeting the goals and that the county that's subject to remedies specified already in statute, that they can make those changes, or the entity assuming the administration of the essential services, that they'd also, those remedies would also be looking at what funding has been allocated, both non-federal, non-state, and that they would be making those changes necessary as well, according to the remedies that are applied. And those are the changes in the legislation that we're looking at. So again, to basically enhance and allow them a little more flexibility to develop these programs across the state.
And so, Senator Dahl, the reason why the bill, I'm assuming we saw this bill last year too, is here is because you're changing some of the duties of the council. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And so, Senator Dahl, in the new language that you have at 610, you, and this is a very tiny thing, but you add that providing review of this redesign process, including proposed memoranda of understanding, which is a plural. But then in number two, you, starting at 620, you refer to only a single one. And I think what you want to do there, and Senator Lori will make this amendment, is to change that to read, ensure the consistency of memoranda of understanding to the extent appropriate with other memoranda of understanding. I think if you're going to use the plural one place, use it everywhere. And if you want to keep it singular, then you need to change it in 610. And I'm going to ask counsel, is it better to talk about any memorandum and then for the consistency, what's best to do there, Mr. Bodern?
Madam Chair, it might be simplest on page 6, line 10, to insert after including any, and then on line 11, delete memoranda and insert memorandum.
Okay. Either one way or the other, but so it doesn't presuppose that you have more than one, but it doesn't limit it to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the council's
suggestions. Okay, so Senator Lori moves to insert after, on line 610, after the word including, insert any.
On line
all the...
Madam Chair, also on line page 6, line 11, delete memoranda and make that memorandum.
And, right. We have Senator Lori's motion. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Are there questions of Senator Dahl regarding the added duties of this council? And I'm assuming your testifiers are there to answer questions.
Right.
Any questions for Senator Dahl? This bill is ready for the floor. Senator Lori moves that Senate File 2908 as amended be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thank you for the birthday greetings, and you are all welcome to come down to the office and have some cupcakes down there.
No?
You can bring them here. We can't leave.
Could send them down.
Yeah, just bring them.
Just a suggestion. Senator Kielash brings us the most complicated title of a bill, I think, that we have before us. And either you or Mr. Workey is going to explain to us what that means. Senator Kielash, Senate File 2756, the first engrossment.
Madam Chair, I have an author's amendment, if I could, just a date change.
We will take the amendment, but it is not an author's amendment because this is not the committee of origination. But,
Madam Chair, it's the effective date.
Just tell us what it is.
Yes, the effective date. Currently, the effective date is the day following publication of the state register. Well, that gives no time for training. And what we'd like to do is change it to 1 year following the day of publication for this to go into effect. So there's time for...
Mr. Bodern, how would that read here?
Madam Chair, I think after... And I'm sorry, I was otherwise distracted. Was that for sections 1 to 3 or section 4?
Section
5
is what we're looking at.
Right, which sections are desired to be made effective? There are two groups here.
There's section 1 to 3 is the one that we're talking about.
Okay. So I think on... page 3, line 12, after effective, insert 1 year after the day. That would work. Why not delete the day and make it 1 year?
Okay. And that's to give the Senator Kielash to give time for people to understand what it is. Is that correct?
Sure. Yep.
So Senator Lori moves... adoption of the amendment to strike the day on line 312 and insert 1 year. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Now, the bill is here because of Section 4, which has to deal with rulemaking. But if you could just briefly describe the bill and then why... We need rulemaking authority here.
Madam Chair, a group, I have some, the committees and some examples here, if that can get passed out. A group has been meeting for well over a year to discuss training and certification for pilot car drivers that are following oversized loads. There is currently no standards on that. Even the State Patrol members are not trained to do oversized loads during the course of their training. So they were involved in the discussion and with the rules and also with designing this bill. There's no fiscal note because the fees for the training will cover the cost of it, and the public safety will take care of the designing the course. It's based on a currently very successful program out of Utah, and it's considered the state of the art in training pilot. But it'll add some safety and eliminate some of the confusion with different jurisdictions as to what's required to do and the extent of what folks driving pilot cars can do as far as traffic control. With me is Tim Workey from the AGC.
DPS needs rulemaking authority. Why? Why can't all of this just be put in the statutes? Why do they need rulemaking authority?
Madam Chair, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Tim Workey. I'm with the Associated General Contractors. Madam Chair, in answer to your question, what you see in this sort of voluminous document that's been passed around is the what I call the template document that our steering committee has worked on that would put in place the standards, procedures, protocols, et cetera, for safe operation of these pilot cars. And in answer to your question, Madam Chair, the reason we felt rulemaking would be more appropriate to ensconce these protocols as the appropriate measures is that these standards often change, whether it be light illuminations or sign legends or retroreflectivity on signs. You know, those standards change regularly, and to put those into law, I don't think you'd want us back here every couple of years changing those laws.
Is there discussion on Senate File 2756, and Senator Kielash, the Finance Committee, has requested it, so it will be sent back there.
Madam Chair?
Senator Rolstein?
We had a real thorough discussion about this in transportation, and at the appropriate time, I'd like to move it.
Senator, is there anyone who wishes to speak in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 2756, the first engrossment as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you
Thank
very
you,
much.
Madam Chair and Committee.
Senator Dibble. Senator Dibble brings us 3115.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present Senate File 3115. Madam Chair and members, perhaps we should. I do have an A2 amendment to offer at the outset. And then I think there's another tiny little
first
change.
Committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, this is the Committee of Origin.
Senator Lurie moves the A2 amendment.
And Madam Chair, while we're moving that, I did notice when I engrossed the A2 amendment that on line 1.7, I think the word A that appears before the word maximum, which becomes then the word annual, should be an.
Let's see, explain again. How is your A2 amendment changed? Maximum.
I don't know how the A2 amendment would be changed other than we need to strike the word A.
On page 1, line 7?
Yeah. And replace that with an.
To an maximum?
An annual. No, sure. Because the word maximum is changed to the
okay,
word annual.
Okay, so it's after on page 1, line 7 of the A2 amendment to before maximum, just to make that phrase to no.
It's going to read an annual
yes.
number of days.
Madam Chair.
A2 amendment, line 1.4. Let's
difference?
Stick an in front of annual.
Right. And strike A.
Oh, wait a minute.
Madam Chair, under the amendment, annual comes after maximum. We could put it in front if we wanted to, but the current.
Okay, so under the amendment.
Oh, I'm sorry,
Alan,
Madam
what,
Chair.
How does that sentence read with the amendment?
I was mistaken. Well, I thought we were striking maximum, but we're keeping maximum. So never mind. Ignore what I just said.
Ever?
The A2 amendment is before us. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We have the bill now in front of us.
We have to work hard for proper grammar.
With parts of proper grammar. Thank you, Senator.
Right. I was trying.
Senator Dibble, your bill.
I need Senator Olson, Madam Chair. She helps me with that stuff. To the bill, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, the City of Minneapolis is undertaking initiative to add to the vibrancy of activity and street life in downtown Minneapolis. And part of what they're proposing to do is encourage more mobile food units to be available to folks as they're walking through downtown. This is particularly important in light of upcoming opening of the Twins ballpark at the edge of downtown. And there's a little provision in state statute that defines a mobile food unit as only being allowed for up to 21 days in any one spot. And so this is a simple change that would allow the City of Minneapolis to establish an annual maximum number of days in any one place. That would obviously, the intent is to be for longer than 21 days. We include language that says the ordinance must include any requirements that the city considers reasonably necessary to protect health, safety, and general welfare of the public, which the city would do in any case, but we just wanted to be sure that, you know, that they were doing that. It's similar in concept to establishing permits and licenses for sidewalk cafes and the like.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. You've got a testifier. Was that four questions?
Are you able,
or would you like to say something?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Henry Reimer. I'm a director in the Minneapolis Regulatory Services Department. I'm here for questions, just a few comments. The main purpose for this narrowly tailored provision is to increase our ability to enhance the vitality of our downtown. We have been engaged with our downtown business community, residents, and workers. We've determined that downtown food carts, mobile food carts, are a necessary component to the vitalization or the vitality of downtown. Our purpose is really to get more people out of the skyways and into the streets. We have been in contact with the State Department of Health. They've expressed no concerns at all with this proposal. As we've looked at how we can have more street food downtown Minneapolis, we've identified the statute as a major barrier to that. Although one of the reasons to make this change is that the 21-day restriction currently in the statute is fairly easily circumvented. However, circumvention is a bureaucratic, costly, expensive, and not a business-friendly method for achieving our results. And so that's really why we're here. Minneapolis has a very robust food inspections operation, and these changes should give no one concern with respect to the safety or health of food that's offered at these units. And with that, I will just stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Reimer. Members, any questions? Seeing none, I would ask if anyone in the audience cares to speak in opposition to this bill. Seeing none, Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 3115, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, members, I did not vote for the final bill, even though I voted for the amendment.
We didn't count your vote last time anyway. Senator Chaudhry. File 2900, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is the annual game and fish bill. It passed the Environment Policy Committee and then the Judiciary Committee. And so we've made a stop here to go over any state and local government related issues, mainly rulemaking. I'll have Ed Bogus fill you in on the details, but it's our understanding that the main portions that relate to this committee are on page 9, section 15, page 27, section 58, page 28, section 60. That's our understanding, but certainly
we
if you have questions
Senator
in other areas, we're happy to talk about those as well.
We have section 27 on our list as well. So as you go through, maybe
okay.
You can just touch on that briefly.
Sure.
And Mr. Bogus, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources. Section 15 on page 9 deals with providing an alternative appeal procedure for a denial of an acquisition request for wildlife management areas. If a county denies right now, the first step is district court. This would maintain that appeal option, but also allow for appeal by either the landowner or the commissioner to the directly to the Land Exchange Board, which is now kind of the last step of appeal. Section, 20, sorry, Mr. Chair, 27.
Page 13, rather.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 27 is part of a change to give the commissioner more flexibility in the rules setting the annual wild turkey seasons. I don't think it creates any new rulemaking authority, because if you see language being stricken on 13.25, there's already rulemaking authority, but this would change the rulemaking authority. Sorry, I missed that one.
I'm sorry.
And then section 58, there are a couple of exemptions to rulemaking. Section 58 deals with a very narrow circumstance in the 1837 ceded territory of Minnesota, which is east central Minnesota. That same treaty with the Chippewa bands extended into northern Wisconsin, and the federal court system all the way through the Supreme Court has ruled that there are rights for Native American bands in both Minnesota and Wisconsin that apply in that part of the state. So we're operating under a set of court orders and protocols that require that we establish a safe harvest and that we allocate the harvest to the bands and to the state anglers. This currently would only affect Lake Mille Lacs, where the state sets a safe harvest level and then has to set regulations to stay within that. We have sometimes in the past had to adjust regulations in July to keep the harvest within the state's allocation if there's unexpectedly what we call a hot bite, where the fish are really biting, or there's more pressure than is expected because gas prices are high and people don't want to go as far to fish. And with our current rulemaking, we have some expedited rulemaking authority that allows us to do a rule within, you know, a month or two, but we don't know if we need to make this adjustment usually till within a week or two of when we need to make it. And so right now we're guessing what that adjustment may need to be in advance, putting it into an expedited rule, and then going with it if the triggers are met that are prescribed in that rule. This narrow exemption to rulemaking authority would allow us to publish in the state register, to attempt to notify interested parties, and to make an adjustment that might be more appropriate to what we actually need to accomplish. The last time we had to do this, our rule that we had done in advance was more restrictive than it would have needed to be, but we didn't have time to do anything differently. The last section, Mr. Chair, that I think is within the jurisdiction of this committee is section 60, and the last paragraph relates to current law, which allows a person under age 16 to transport certain species of game fish for display in a home aquarium that are taken by angling. And there's a general law against transporting live game fish in the state because we don't want people moving fish from one body of water to another. A few years ago, we did some viral hemorrhagic septicemia legislation where we had proposed to repeal this. At that time, the legislature did not agree to that. So now we're coming back with a proposal that if we find a emergency fish disease in Minnesota waters, the commissioner then could, by written order, make this section of law ineffective and prohibit the transportation of game fish for aquarium purposes. That currently you can buy game fish from pet shops for aquarium purposes or from private fish hatcheries, and it's really the last unregulated way that you can legally transport live game fish in the state. And obviously the concern isn't for the fish in the aquarium. It's if they get tired of them, if they get too big, are they going to put them in another body of water when they're done with them? So, Mr. Chair, that's it. I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bogus. Any questions of committee members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I have one, and I don't serve on the committee that Senator Chaudhry chairs, and it isn't related to rulemaking, but it is a rule. I mean, it would be a state law. and that's regarding the age of hunters for deer hunting. On page 14, line 33, it says that someone, and I think this is brand new, that someone 12 years of age or under and is accompanied by a parent or guardian can now go out for firearm or bow and arrow to take deer. Is that new?
Mr. Bargess, Senator Chaudhry?
Mr.
Bargess?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, the current law allows persons down to age 10. This would not set a minimum age in statute. It would leave it to parental discretion to establish that, which is the case for pheasant, duck, rabbit, squirrel hunting right now, where there's no minimum age in statute for those types of hunting. So this is a change from current law.
Senator Roebling.
I am a little troubled because that means they could take a rifle. They can have a range of a couple of miles sometimes. Can they take a rifle?
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, yes, they could, but there's also, this is part, the section that you're getting into is part of a proposal for what we're calling youth hunting simplification, and there are some definitions. They have to be accompanied, and if I could just call your attention to...
Which, just page. For the record, we're getting quite far afield of state and local jurisdiction, so we will try to be brief on this line of questioning. But
I would just, on page 8, lines 4 to 6, describes how those youth could hunt big game, and you can see that they would have to be accompanied by a parent or guardian who's in close enough proximity to immediately assume control of the youth hunter's firearm or bow.
So, Mr. Chair.
And that's also new language.
So they'd have to be in the deer stand with their child?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, yes, they would have to be, they'd either have to have two stands if they're up in a tree, or they'd have to be on the ground where they could immediately assume control of the firearm or the bow. If they're under age 13.
Any other questions of members?
6 years old.
Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 2900? Seeing none, Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 2900, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Senator Olson. We have Senate File 1657, is that correct?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this is a bill that would provide a process, a two-year process, to look at realigning natural resources management. It does not have a foregone conclusion in terms of what the end result would look like, but it provides for very broad participation among agencies within state government, with local government, provides for citizen participation. And basically what it tries to do is it provides that we take kind of a very broad-based look, trying to look at bringing our natural resources realignment into the 21st century. It lists some goals that the group looking at this are charged to accomplish, including those would be the duties on subdivision 2, beginning at page 2.20 on page 2, which include reducing administrative personnel, having accountability to the public, consolidating the project permitting functions, and so forth and so on, a reduction in overall management, redundant management personnel. That was language added in the Ag Committee. And also added in the Ag Committee were a number of additional members, just to make sure you have the latest engrossment, so that there would be 8 members representing the farm and ag community that would be a part of this this organization or this task force. Members, the idea here is that our constituents are asking us to look in a broad way at how we might deliver government services in a better, more efficient, more responsive way. And so that is the goal of this bill, is to move in that direction. I could go into a lot of the policy reason for this, but I'm not sure how far you want me to go with that effort. I can tell you that this has been through 3 committees with broad bipartisan support. And also, members, there is an amendment that's been prepared by counsel of this committee. I think mostly nothing substantive, basically some technical changes that are suggested to comport with the requirements of this committee. And that would be the A4 amendment.
Okay. We're getting the A4 amendment passed out. Senator Olsen, we'll move the A4 amendment, and you've just described it, correct?
Mr. Chair, would you like me to walk through the A4 amendment?
Briefly.
Okay. Mr. Chair, on page 1, line 20, after Senate... would be inserting including one member and deleting subcommittee on committee of the, and insert majority leader. So that would make a difference. And basically the next through line 1.5 is just clarifying who makes the appointments to be more consistent with the way that those appointments are normally handled. On line 1.6, delete 2 members, and after representatives, again, these are really kind of technical housekeeping language changes.
It's just who makes the appointments and making sure there's balance between the minority caucus and how that's done, and changing management and budget. Okay. I think we can.
Right.
All right. We can see that pretty standard stuff that we do here. So Olsen renews his motion on the A4 amendment. Any further discussion on the A4? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the bill. Are you done with your presentation?
I am, Mr. Chair, to the extent that it specifically relates, I think, to your issues here. But to the extent you want to go into it more broadly or not, I'll leave that to the committee and stand for any questions if you have them.
We'll open it up for questions. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olsen, I'm just looking at this bill now kind of quickly, but it seems to me that the composition of this board is pretty heavy on agricultural interests, and it doesn't, and I'm just wondering what your response is to that, and why, what got you there, and why there isn't more balance towards maybe environmental interests and agricultural interests.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Initially, as the bill was written, there really isn't a distinction other than from different levels of government and different agencies where who would be the representative. So, for example, if the legislature is appointing a member, would that member be someone from an environmental group, or would that member be someone representing a farming organization? There really wasn't a lot of definition. There were a lot of definite parameters. When the bill was considered by the Agricultural Committee, the concern was that there was a certainty that there was at least going to be representation there. So you have 8 agricultural members out of a total committee membership of 20, I believe it has risen to like 20, 26 or 28 members. 26 members. So we still have a lot of room, subtracting 8 from the 26 for representatives abroad, of environmental groups and their representatives. I can tell you if you have a concern along those lines, Senator Steben, I would be happy to work with you and would consider it, you know, a friendly amendment if you would like to take within that 26 and specifically designate some particular representation or groups. I don't think that would be out of the spirit of what the Ag Committee agreed with, because I think the idea is to have as broad representation as possible, provided that we don't get, I don't think we want a really a larger committee, though, because if you start to get 40 or 50 members as your working group, it starts to get awfully large.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not real certain about, I mean, without undoing the work of the Agricultural Committee, for instance, it seems like the Minnesota's Farmers Union and the Farm Bureau rep and the Agri-Growth Council also represents interests of the corn growers, soybean growers, cattlemen, pork producers, and milk producers. But again, without undoing that, if there are 8 agricultural interests or representatives, perhaps, I'm not sure, perhaps we should think about also adding 8 representatives of environmental or public health interests as well, just to balance it out.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I have the feeling that the Agricultural Committee sort of expected that that would be the case. I didn't want to determine who those groups would be. But my goal here is to have broad participation and a balance of interests. And so, as I said, to the extent that, you know, between this, between here and what happens in the Finance Committee, if you have suggestions for me or specific groups, then I would consider that to be a friendly addition, and I would be happy to work with you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, would you be willing to allow us to lay the bill aside for the time being? We could work on it right now and then bring the bill back up.
Mr. Chair, would it still be able to be passed today so that we could meet a deadline?
I think that's what Senator Steben is talking about, is to just have a side conversation about it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I really don't feel comfortable with this the way it is right now. I mean, it just looks like it's totally stacked. And I don't feel like it's very balanced in terms of, I think we do way too much delegating of our authority anyway toward a lot of outside groups. And when you have something like this, which is supposed to be merging environmental and natural resources committees, and yet it looks like it's totally controlled by the ag community, that seems very strange to me, very out of balance.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, as I said, I'm very open. These were specific requests by the Ag Committee, but I think the expectation was, and my expectation was, if there are specific groups that need to be named or that you or Senator Steben would like to name, I think that's fine. There really isn't, though, an intent to overbalance to Ag, because the idea is that these are 8 members out of 26 and that the other 26 members could certainly be, you know, plenty of room to include the environmental groups. If we want to specifically name them, I think that's also fine. But the overall thing also to remember is that this would be a recommendation to come back to the legislature, and whatever is recommended is going to have to be approved by the legislature. And so I think that if any group tries to be not environmentally protective, which is the ultimate goal of this, is to streamline and make more efficient but more effective environmental protection, then it's not going to pass the legislature. So I would like to work with you and Senator Steben to make sure that your concerns are satisfied here.
So So we will lay Senate File 1657 on the table with one comment. I mean, these were, I do sit on the Ag Committee, and these were, you know, specifically inserted in the Ag Committee, and I think they would likely view unfavorably taking some of these out, adding, you know, more balance. I mean, it is less than a third of the members. Ag is about a third of our economy in Minnesota, and we do need to work with these groups.
Mr. Chairman, a third of our economy? Since when?
Yes. Yes.
It used to be.
Absolutely.
All of it.
Absolutely. Ag is very, very important.
I'm not saying it isn't important. It's just a third. It's hard to believe.
I think that does surprise people.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, what was the order of committees that this bill went through?
Mr. Chair, this bill passed through Environmental Policy Committee first. And I think had I don't know if there were any dissenting votes actually in any of these committees. Then it went through Environmental Finance. Then it went to Ag, and now it's here.
Mr. Chairman, Pappas. So before it went to Ag, how was the representation?
Mr. Chair, before it went to Ag, it was try to get this right. There were no specific groups identified, so it was kind of more broadly left open.
And who were the appointing authorities in that case?
It specifically said that there was a division between the House, the Senate, and the governor's office in terms of the appointing authorities. And it also somewhat delineated that there had to be representation from the state agencies and then local government entities and the tribes. What was added in Ag was the specific agencies, and there was actually some discussion in Ag, so there was a bit of a compromise, Senator Pappas, because I think what the Ag Committee chair would have done would have been just to say that within the 18 members of the committee as it stood at that time, that the 8 of the 18 would be these Ag representatives. Instead, what happened was that they were added on top so that there was still plenty of room to allow for designations of the environmental groups. And then also what was added in Ag was that it, and I think this was a good addition as well, was that there would be a minority and majority member from each body so that there would be some continuity with these recommendations coming back into the legislature, that there would be participation from someone in the legislature to be able to come back and explain and probably be authoring together the bill that would kind of put into place the proposals.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I tend to agree that 8 out of 26 is not that overwhelming. And I, you know, coming from a farm myself, I realize that the farm community works more with these groups probably than most anyone, especially the Water and Soil Resources Board. And they work a lot with the DNR and pollution control. And they are the owners of a lot of this land that will be affected by a potential merger. And so I guess that they should have a fairly strong voice, not a dominant voice, but a strong voice at the table as this is being considered for restructuring. And so I don't know. Were there specific ideas that we should table it for, or could we just move it?
Well, I guess, Madam Chair, it was Senator Siebman's suggestion, and maybe if we take a lunch break, conversations can be had about, you know, something that seems to be more of an equal balance. I think we have a long agenda here. We'll probably be here till 4 o'clock, so I think there's time to kind of work some changes into this.
Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I would just like to say to all concerned that my goal with this bill, and I think if we're going to actually accomplish this, if we really want to accomplish some reform, we do that best by making sure that we have as broad an inclusion as possible and that we try to get all the voices at the table. In my opinion, the idea is not to overly balanced this one direct way to or the other. But if you think about it, the way that the things are structured right now, we have different groups, whether it's ag over here, health over here, DNR over here, Bowser over here, sort of doing their own thing. And then if we want to be effective in managing environmental policy, we want to get all these people together to figure out how they could perhaps more be more cooperative. This is not a bill that necessarily creates a giant super agency. It doesn't predetermine any result. But I think the best way to look at good environmental policy is to get all these players at the table and figure out the best way to be effective in managing for the environment.
And I would just note once again, I mean, I'm going to follow the author's lead as to her preferences with this. But we have a bill that has come through the Environment Committee and the Ag Committee, and they have told us what the balance they would like to see in this bill is. It's here before us, having come through those committees. And if we,
while
we're looking at the mechanics of it, change the balance, I think these committees may take serious issue with the work done in this committee.
Well, Senator Mr. Pappas. Chairman, it sounds to me it was radically changed in the Ag Committee. It's not like the balance was determined and then it was approved by each of these committees. So I just think that we need to take a step back as not being on any of the policy committees, as just the state government committee, and make sure that we have the proper balance. And I think Senator Sieben had a good idea about if we're going to designate so many positions for ag, then maybe we need to designate so many positions for other interests.
And I think that's a good, valid point, and we're discussing that. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, if that's the wish of this committee, as I said, I'd be very happy to work with Senator Sieben, Senator Pappas, and just want to make sure that I can be back here before the end of the day, because I really think that there's been broad bipartisan support to move this forward.
We're going to lay over Senate File 1657 temporarily in order to address the concerns of the committee members. We'll come back to it.
Thank
Senator,
you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson. I know. I see you, Senator Salzman. We're going to respect Senator Pogemiller's schedule and take him next. Right. We'll come get you. Yes, Senator Pogemiller.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Pogemiller sits down. We had discussed, you and I, earlier about did the committee, since we're probably going to go to 4 o'clock, want to take a half-hour lunch break. And I just wanted to suggest that maybe we do that around 1 o'clock.
Is that agreeable to members that we go as far as we can until at 1 and then come back at 1:30 and be prompt? We'll just take a recess then. I think we're making wonderful progress, and I really well we are. I mean, we have a long agenda, and we're now on the 15th bill out of 26. So, Senator Pogemiller,
Madam Chair, is this a good time? I just saw what happened to Senator Olson.
We're standing in the way of the committee
having lunch. Okay,
just keep that in mind. Senator Pogemiller brings us Senate File 2874.
Madam Chair, members, Senate File 2874 is a referral from the Business
Jobs and Industry
Jobs
Senator
and Industry Committee.
Metzen's committee, and so we are looking at the first engrossment.
Correct. And it's a fairly simple bill in its notion. It's employee-empowered reorganization of agencies. The two agencies that this, it could be applied to other agencies, but the two agencies this applies to are DEED and DOLLI. And it sets up an employee process to redesign the agencies. Perhaps it ends up one agency. And to do it in a way where there's enough incentive so that people are willing to do the work, but not too much incentive so that they fetally retract and try to block change. And so what the bill does is sets up, there's a three-step process. And the first two sections are very important, but I wasn't going to highlight these in this committee.
We're interested in section three.
Correct, but I just want to mention the first two sections basically lay out what is it that you're trying to accomplish with the reorganization. And so the focus, I think, from a policy perspective in the other committee should have been is on those two sections.
Right.
We're trying, and I won't go through those. So what are these task forces or these three-step processes going to do? The first step is to set up three groups. One is a group of managers. That's 3.7 to 3.10, and 10 to 15 managers. The next step, the next group is line workers, 3.11 to 3.13. And the third group is outside experts who are members of labor organizations, business, higher ed, an attorney experienced in workers' comp law. These three groups would blue sky what they think an organization should look like to accomplish the goals and outcomes of the first two sections. At a point of their working, a subgroup of them will be set up, but that is section, that's subdivision two, where a smaller group, representatives from each one of those three groups, one from management, labor, and outside, come together and start to, in a detailed manner, come up with a consensus organizational structure that they think the legislature and the governor would think are a good idea. That group then would present that to the legislature and the governor by next January. The governor then would presumably work that into his or her budget, and the legislature would do whatever's necessary legislatively to reorganize the agencies. There is a safety valve here. If the legislature and the governor don't like the work that was done, the agencies aren't eliminated. But the intent here is that they will do good work. The governor and the legislature will say, okay, that makes some sense. And then the agencies would basically be abolished and something would replace them. Parallel to that second step, there would be an internal employee participation committee set up that would actually, and you can see this on lines on the top of page 5, identify the tasks, the specific tasks, and adopt plans to actually implement the reorganization. So you got three groups going here. The first two are, the first one blue skies it. The second one takes the blue sky activity of the three groups and puts them together so that you have one plan. And then this third group of employees, some of me who may be these previous people, perhaps, not necessarily, but perhaps, they actually identify in a workflow, how do you actually do this? How do you retrain affected employees? How do you address the various issues that come with reorganization, you know, letterhead and whatever is necessary? That's the simple notion. It is supported by AFSCME, by MAPE. It is supported by at least one of the commissioners involved, Commissioner Sfigum. And I think what it sets in place is a template to allow two complex organizations, and I'll just mention Deed is about 1,600 employees, $736 million budget. Dolly is 500 employees, $272 million budget. And both of those budgets are by and large federal money, interestingly. That's why there may be some issues of accountability here, because it's not our money. It's somebody else's, most of this money. And so I think these two agencies would provide a good example of how this could work to both get higher productivity, better service, and perhaps do that all at a same or a lower price. That's the concept. It's fairly simple, and be open to success. Oh, Article 2 of the bill then, which is not intimate.
Jurisdiction.
It's not intimate to this bill, is a broadening out of something apparently a Transportation Committee did, Transportation Accountability Act, and this broadens it out to other agencies. And it gets to this issue of is it cheaper to contract out or not? So I know it's not this committee's responsibility, and I should point out on Article 2, Department of Administration has suggested that it needs some work, and I've told them I'm willing to do that. I obviously don't want to pass something that doesn't work, but everybody's interested in putting into this debate between labor and management as to whether contracting out is less expensive or more expensive.
Senator Pogemiller, the on page 4, line 20, I wonder if you would, usually when we ask for reports to be made to someone, we include the legislative committees of the or the committees of the legislature, as well as an agency head, or in this instance, the governor. And we have language that says, shall submit its recommendations then for reorganization to the governor and to the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative commissions with or legislative committees with jurisdiction over state and local government or state government policy and finance.
This might, it would be fine to add it there. I might point out that the tasks and actual adoption of plan type activities on page 5 is directed, lines 5.7 to 5.9, is directed to the committees of jurisdiction. The overall concept is to the legislature, but I think it would be fine to add language where you're suggesting that also directs it to those specific committees. That's fine. If that's the way you normally do it, I think
we usually
that's fine.
Do it there. And thank you for pointing out on page 5, we also request that the reports be made to the ranking members of the minority members the committees.
That sounds like boilerplate language. That'd be fine.
It's boilerplate language. So let's take care of that first. Senator Olsen moves that boilerplate language with regard to making the reports. All those in favor, say
Chair,
aye.
Madam Chair, where does that appear? At 5 and where? 7?
It's at 5.8 to the chairs and ranking minority members. And then also on 4.20, submit its recommendation for reorganization to the governor and strike and the legislature, and instead insert chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative committees with primary policy jurisdiction over state government.
And Madam Chair, page 7, line 13. Commissioner Administration must report.
Page, I'm sorry, say
7.13.
And page 7, 13, to, again, have it to people, not to an institution. Okay. Same language. And there are a couple of other minor things, too, but if we could take care of that, that reporting thing first. And Senator Pogemiller, council suggests that not only state policy, but the committees with jurisdiction over economic development. So if that can be understood as the amendment in those three places.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bodern.
In the third instance, for the report on the Taxpayer Accountability Act provisions, I assume you want the committees with jurisdiction over taxes.
Oh, I think that's the Finance Committee, isn't administration? Isn't the? I think Finance Committee. That's normally who deals with Department of Administration, those kinds of things. This is about contracting.
Okay. So
okay.
Over
so
finance.
So in that one, in 7.13, reports to the chairs and ranking minority members of legislative committees with jurisdiction over state government finance. Okay, understood that amendment, that Senator Lurie's amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Pogemiller also, back on 4.20, what we typically ask these groups to do that are making recommendations is also to include draft legislation. So it's not just recommendations that sit on the shelf, but they've actually considered how to change the statute. So on 4.20, following reorganization, to insert including draft legislation. Senator Lurie moves that amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. And then generally, Senator Pogemiller, we have been giving people just a little bit more time, and asking for reports to be made by February 1st rather than January 15th. Would that be agreeable to you? Since these groups are, you know, starting really October 1st, a lot of people are gone the last couple of weeks of December and or around the first of the year. Does it harm your bill?
Well, it's a long budget year, so the sooner the better, I think, though, because if these activities would have to be implemented in that legislative session. And the governor, the intent here is for the governor to include this in his or her budget. So I don't know, maybe you should leave it January 15th.
If you want to leave it January 15th, that's fine. We have the including draft legislation, however, adopted, did we not?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, and on that point on page 7, line 13, regarding the Taxpayers Accountability Act, that report is due by September 1st of each year, which is during the time when the legislative session is not meeting. Now, if it, given the fact that we've got two election cycles over the next 3 years, it could very well be the reports are sent to some chairs and ranking minority members who may not even be in that position when the legislative session starts. So I'm not quite sure what purpose it serves. January 15th sounds better
than me.
There's
nobody here September 1st. So Senator Betzel moves on line 714 to strike September 1 and insert January 15th each year. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Is there anyone who wishes to speak either in support or in opposition to the jurisdictional issues for this committee on Senate File 2874? Mr. Rhodes.
He wants to talk about Article 2, and you don't. That's not in your jurisdiction?
No, we just helped you out with that reporting date.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Rhodes, Department of Administration, just for clarification, this bill then will go to where?
Finance.
What's the next stop? It would go to finance then? Because that's where we can work out those
yes,
things.
It goes to finance.
And thank you very much.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Pogemeier, just real quick, I really like the idea of the buy-in, because you presented this bill in the Jobs Committee the other day, and one of the points you made was the survivability of administrations and commissioners as they come and go, and getting some employee buy-in can help make changes long-lasting. So I really like that. My question is the model, that way you have this task force set up where you very specifically have three defined groups and you specifically say they're going to meet separately and then come together. We have all sorts of proposals. I mean, we're doing one with Senator Olson's on the same similar thing, but dealing with environmental agencies, whereas you're dealing with jobs and economic development piece of things, and it's a whole different model. And I'm wondering, is the model you're following, did that come from some sort of a organizational management guru, a think tank, somebody where it says this is the best way to do this? And if it is, can we use that in others? Or where did you come up with the plan?
The framework is one that is based on the national... Madam Chair, based on national literature, some of Deming's work and stuff, but I don't know that I can point to a specific state that has done it this way. I kind of tried to back into it by figuring out who are the stakeholders, who's going to feel their ox is going to get gored, and how do you get them to get together and not focus on that, focus on how maybe it could be better for all of them. And the obvious thing first is managers versus line workers. And then, of course, inbreeding is potentially a problem. That's why you need some outside people who might say, yeah, but have you thought about this? And then let them blue sky it first, but then force them then to work it out among themselves in a smaller group. So I can't give you a specific reference where this has worked exactly this way. It's kind of a conglomeration of reading the literature around the states and talking with AFSCME about what their principles are for reorganization. Keep in mind that the major thing to overcome here is the people that are in these agencies for a long time. They are typically the most resistant to change, a combination of out of fear, but also out of the, hey, I'm doing it right now, why would I want to change? So it seems to me this combination potentially can work. I'm not positive. I don't know this has been done exactly like this in any other state, but having been around here 20-some years, it looks like it might work. I do know, I'm absolutely certain, having served with six governors now, it doesn't happen when you bring in a blue ribbon panel and have them, outside experts, tell us how to rearrange state government. It just doesn't work. They might have brilliant ideas, but until you have the employees willing to do it, it isn't going to happen.
Madam Chair,
I don't know if that's not totally sure, responsive, I don't think.
I just think we have so many different models and ways to do this. We should probably try to figure out what is the best practice for reorganizing agencies. And much like we have our checklist for items of, when a task force is formed, maybe we have a best practices checklist of reorganization. And if there is a superior model, then we should find it and use it across the board.
Further discussion, Senator Betzel.
Just a question on the effective date on page 6, section 8. Sections 5 and 7 are effective July 1st, 2011. I get that. But then the next sentence tries to explain it's based on an assumption the legislature may act on this. Well, maybe they will, maybe they won't, but that doesn't change anything if July 1st, 2011 comes around and this is on the books. So why do we have to have an explanation of the assumptions and the effective date? Either you have an effective date or you don't have an effective date.
Senator Pogue-Miller?
Originally, the bill did have just a straight-up repeal. I don't know why, but some people aren't certain that the governor and the legislature will actually agree to something. And so I think people are asking for some comfort language that, you're not just going to eliminate the agencies, are you? You're actually going to try to replace it with something else. I personally don't have that fear, but I think many do. So this is kind of, I thought what you were going to say to me is, does that language actually work? And I was going to say, well, I'm not sure.
Well, Senator Pogue-Miller, does it work?
Senator Betzel? Senator Pogue-Miller?
Well, I'm not sure it does.
Okay. Madam Chair, maybe we should just delete it then if we're not sure if it's going to work. Again, you have an effective date, and what typically happens if the legislature meets and decides, well, we need to push it back or we need to revise something, the legislature can do that. But having an effective date and then trying to explain what we're assuming is going to happen doesn't change the effective date. You still have an effective date.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Pogue-Miller.
Senator Betzold. Let me work on that a little longer. I'd prefer if you'd leave the language in.
Senator Betzold. Okay. Senator Perry.
Madam Chair. Senator Pogue-Miller.
Thank you, Senator Betzold.
Though I admire your desire to streamline and control growth in government and maybe even reduce the size of government, help me with just a little bit of fear I have in the direction this is going based on what we heard that Senator Gerlach mentioned at our last committee. What concerned me was a statement when you say there's buy-in by Ask Me and Make. What really concerned me when I left that meeting was there is a buy-in unless this committee comes up with the fact that we have too many employees. And with that coming out in that meeting, it leads me to believe that will we really get true buy-in by these employee representatives when, in fact, in real life, they know that they might be eliminating some of their positions. Now, I guess that helped me with that statement that was made because it was, I think it was Senator Tomassoni that asked specifically that question to the two union leaders. And they both, they said, well, no.
I thought that was an interesting discussion, Madam Chair. And you'll recall that I made some comments around Senator Tomassoni's comments. I don't think the objective here, state employment is not a, or state government is not a jobs program. It's a service organization. And so you only want to have enough people doing the job or using taxpayers' money that accomplish the task you're trying to accomplish. There is always attrition in agencies. So I think there is room for work there. Nobody fears that somebody else's job is going to be lost. They typically fear their job is going to be lost. And so private sector, public sector, that's the way we all are. Matter of fact, many of us are experiencing that this year because it's an election year. And so I think my answer is, I think what the labor leaders said, they obviously cannot, they're not going to say publicly, we're for fewer state employees. They're not going to say that. They're an organization based on the number, you know, they get a payment from as many people as they've got, right? But I thought they were very careful to say that if it's an employee-powered reorganization that makes sense, that employees think accomplishes the job that they're there for, that they can be supportive of that. I think there will be some tension around that, but I think it'll work out. And the final arbiter in the end, of course, is the legislature and the governor, because the option is we get to decide how many people are in these agencies. And where we struggle is we try to decide how many people can be there, and we're just not certain that the job that we're hoping gets done is being done as effectively as it could be. And I think what I'm obviously admitting is that I don't think we can know that answer unless the employees tell us. It's kind of that way in any business. Now, we have customers, too, who say, you know, nobody ever answered my phone call. So we get that feedback, too. But in the end, we don't really know whether these agencies are working as high a level of productivity as we would like. We use signals, you know. And in these two agencies, what I would argue is they clearly aren't accomplishing as much as we need to have accomplished. And I don't mean that as a criticism of the current set of employees or the current management. I'm just saying we are not performing at the same level we have historically performed in terms of job growth and so forth. Our state agencies have a limited role in that, but they have some role. And historically, we have actually performed better as a community in terms of making the right choices for economic growth in our employment sector and so forth. So I guess the final part of the answer is, if we don't try something like this, I think we're going to be in the same position we're in right now, which is all we can do is cut back. We can't actually find out if we're going to get better level of service or not.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Senator Pogamiller, you're much more optimistic about this than I am. I just had a little bill last year that would have had background checks done for family daycare providers by the state instead of the counties, and it affected, there could have been a couple of positions lost in counties, and there might have had to have been one or two more positions added at the state level. And the Ask Me union that represents the county employees killed the proposal in the end, even though the family daycare providers really wanted it and we thought it would be a much more efficient system. It came down to where some jobs might be lost. And so I'm not real hopeful, because that was just a very small example of one thing. But based on your comments earlier that, you know, that we don't have a jobs program, but we have a service program for our taxpayers, I'm kind of wondering about the provision on page 7 dealing with contracts, where it says that before an agency can contract outside of their employees, they have to meet all of these qualifications, and those are good things. They have to decide that it would be more cost-effective if they did a contract, that they don't have the professional expertise within their system to do it. But then this little part on page 7.9, even after they do all of that, it says the contract, together with other contracts to which the department is or has been a party, will not violate Section 16C.08, and I'm not exactly sure, I'd have to look that up, or otherwise reduce full-time equivalent positions within the department. So we're saying that After we find out that it's not as expensive to contract, that we will at least get the same level of quality work or better, we can't do it if we're going to lose any full-time positions. So I'm struggling with that. That's not a reorganization then. If it's cheaper and better quality going outside with a contract, but we can't do it if we're going to lose a position, what are we gaining?
Senator Pogamiller.
Two things I want to point out. Article 2 is not related to the first article, so not to the reorganization. Article 2 is something that was added based on what I've been told happened in the Transportation Department. They adopted something called the Transportation Accountability Act in Senator Murphy's committee a couple years ago. And what this language intends to do is broaden it. It apparently has worked in the Department of Transportation, I'm told. So it seems to me, based on just reading what you just read, that that perhaps is a little tight there, because it may not allow what you need to accomplish once you've proven that you maybe can do this with a contract. So this language will be studied in the Finance Committee very thoroughly. And at first blush, I kind of agree with what you just said, but I don't know enough about it to know whether there's a further explanation.
Any other comments?
Senator Robley, someone was looking for a vehicle, and they figured this would be a good vehicle.
Madam Chair.
Anyone wish in the public wish to speak for or against this bill?
Does that brutal honesty bug you sometimes? Just told you the truth. Someone was looking for a vehicle, and here it is.
Yeah, they did it. Is there further discussion on Senate File 2874, the first engrossment as amended? Seeing none, Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 2874, the first engrossment as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. We're going to do one more tiny
thank
bill.
Thank you, Committee Members, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Pogamiller. Senator Lurie, because he does have, following our break, he's up right away in Judiciary Committee. So this is a 30-second, consent calendar bill. There needs to be no testimony, just an explanation.
This is Senate File 3167, Town Meeting Minute Authentication. Right now, this is in statute. Right now, the election judges are required to sign annual meetings. This is from a time when all townships ran their annual meeting and their annual elections at the same time. They don't do that anymore. Sometimes there's not judges available to sign the minutes. This allows the clerk and a moderator to sign the minutes of the annual meeting. That's the extent of the
and
bill.
And if the clerk is serving as a moderator, then it must be the moderator and a supervisor.
Yep.
Any questions about Senate File 3167? Any objection to it going on the consent calendar?